Good afternoon. I'm going to be talking about the impact of armed conflict on non-combatant civilians. I receive a small amount of royalties from books that I've co-edited on war, terrorism, and social injustice and the relationship to public health. I recognize that the overall title of this session, I think, is The Vietnam War is Still Going On. And it may not be going on in Vietnam, but some of the same forces, some of the same types of misperceptions that led this country and allies into the Vietnam War are obviously still operative in the world. We're still, in many places, I think, making certain assumptions that are not really based on understanding of the culture and the local politics and the geopolitics. We still have overwhelming, in fact, even more overwhelming than during the Vietnam War. Some people call the American War in Vietnam because there was a French War in Vietnam before that. But the power of the military, industrial, and might I add, academic complex, that the power of that complex is stronger now than perhaps it ever was. You know, the phrase that if you ask a carpenter to see a problem, he or she will see a nail, and a hammer is the way to address the problem. We see many problems in the world through the lens of a military approach. And so many of those same things, you know, the Vietnam War, the American War in Vietnam is quote-unquote over, but our approach, that is the U.S. approach to foreign policy, has arguably not changed, and in some respects taken a step or two backwards since that time. I want to start with a few pieces of data, and actually we must remember behind every death or every injury there's a human being and a family and community of which that human being is a part. And so I'm going to cite some statistics here, but we need to remember, as my colleague Vic Seidel and I have often said, is that statistics about war and conflict are people with the tears, in some ways, the tears washed away. So here's some recent data on the conflict in Syria, although we recognize that these data are probably incomplete and maybe off by quite a bit. But between March 2011 and August 2014, an estimated 191 people died. More than 40,000 of them were civilians. It may indeed be much, much more than that. At least 4,000 women, at least 8,800 children. More than 6.4 million people. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine. We think there's a lot of people here at the meeting, 10,000, 13,000 people. You know, 6.4 million people displaced. More than 3 million refugees. So more than 3.4 million people displaced within Syria, and as we know from so many other conflicts, the people who are displaced within their own country often have a worse fate. If you're a refugee and you get to a so-called host country or at a refugee center in another country, some of your basic needs will likely be provided. If you're a displaced person, maybe none of those needs will certainly not be provided by somebody else, and you yourself as a displaced person may not be able to provide them. In the Iraq War between March 2003 and June 2011, approximately 405,000 excess deaths are attributable to the conflict. Some surveys show it to be a lot more than that. This is a study done by Amy Hagopian and others that was published about a year ago. The civil war in the Democratic Republic of Congo since 1998, probably more than 6 million people have died in the conflict as a result of those numbers are results of studies done by the International Rescue Committee, more than 2.4 million internally displaced, more than 500,000 refugees. And by the way, most of the people who died in that conflict, a large fraction of which were non-combatant civilians, died as a result not of, of bombs and incendiaries and bullets, but rather the fact of destruction of the health-supporting infrastructure. There were no clinics, no public health services. Food and water delivery systems for safe food and safe water were not available, and on and on. So a lot of it has to do with the destruction of the infrastructure. The way I first got interested and involved in issues related to war and conflict, at least indirectly, was working in a Cambodian refugee camp in 1980. I was there as part of a team from the International Rescue Committee, Cornell Medical College, and New York Hospital. This is a refugee camp called Khao Yai Dung, where about 125,000 people lived. You may recall that from 1975 to 1979, Cambodia was controlled by the Khmer Rouge, who took over the country, depopulated the cities, forced people into the countryside. Anyone who had any ties with the West or even was suspected of having ties with the West, anyone with an education, anyone who wore glasses was often summarily killed, so people got rid of their glasses. They got rid of any traces of being educated people, that many people pretended to be peasant farmers just in order to survive. It's estimated that between 1 million and 1.5 million of Cambodia's 7 million people died during that almost four-year period, many of them due to hunger, disease, because there were no doctors, there were no public health services. Many people were, as I said, were summarily executed. It wasn't until January of 1979 when the Vietnamese army invaded Cambodia. You could argue for geopolitical reasons, but they invaded Cambodia, took over Cambodia, and people were then free. And towards the end of that year, many people, Thailand opened its border in October and November, I believe, of 1979, and before closing its border again. And during that period of time, more than 125,000 people crossed the border, many of them coming to this refugee camp. By the way, they built their own homes, their huts that you see here, made of thatch and bamboo with materials provided by the UN and other agencies. Some of the health issues we saw in the camp where I was for a couple of months, of course, many people were there for a lot longer. This young boy, I believe he was about 10 years old, you can see a scar on his, the lights were dimmer, you can see a scar on his abdomen and another on his left arm. He had been crossing the Thai-Cambodian border where there's still fighting going on. He was wounded and survived. The four-year-old brother that he was carrying was killed. And so there are still people getting killed, even though the Khmer Rouge had been removed from power. This seven-year-old girl had severe malnutrition. Of course, malnutrition not only leads to intellectual dysfunction, but puts children and adults at increased risk of dying from diseases that they would otherwise not die from, such as measles. She weighed 27 pounds. When I came home, I almost did not recognize my one-year-old son, who's now 35, who weighed the same amount, 27 pounds, because I had been seeing such malnourished children during this period of time. By the way, people gave me permission to take all these pictures at the time. On the right is a Catholic Relief Services nurse. On the left is an 11-year-old boy who could not see. His eyes were seemingly abnormal. He had what's called psychological blindness. He had actually witnessed both his parents being killed. And, of course, many children and adults had severe, what we might label as post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, other mental disorders, which are likely to be lifelong scars as a result of what they had witnessed and what they had gone through in Cambodia. On the positive side, there were about 10 wards in the camp. They were built by the UN and other relief agencies. You can see women sitting on the, this is the pediatrics ward with about 100 patients, women who are the mothers of these children assisting with their care. By the way, the care, although it was low tech, you could say, we still had adequate medicines to treat what we were dealing with, largely infectious diseases and malnutrition. We did not need a lot of high tech in terms of MRIs and CAT scans and so forth. And we had a very effective medical record system and X-ray retrieval system because people carried their medical records on 3x5 cards and little glassine, you know, sandwich pouches and carried their own X-rays with them, which was very effective in keeping track of problems. There was a rehab center in the camp. This man was at the rehab center. You can see some markings on his chest, which are a result of a traditional medical practice, sometimes called coining. And there was an eye clinic in the camp where people could get glasses. This man, as I said, people had to discard their glasses simply to survive. This man said, you know, I can see for the first time in 4 years. Children and adults were provided with diets that were similar to their diets in Cambodia, largely rice and vegetables. There was a supplemental feeding center for those who were malnourished and for pregnant women. The UN trucked 70 trucks like this, tanker trucks, into the camp each day because there was not adequate, safe water. And as some of you who worked in refugee situations know, and of course many of them are a result of war, that safe water is usually not available. So at great cost, they trucked in water to ensure that the water would be safe. When polio occurred, there was a team of 50 Cambodian public health workers. Many of them had been public health workers or nurses or other healthcare workers in Cambodia who had pretended not to be that for the 4 years of the Khmer Rouge. When there was a polio outbreak in the camp, they helped to administer, as shown here, oral polio vaccine. And many of them attended a course that we put on to improve their skills in public health, talking about surveillance and simple measures for, but effective measures for infectious disease control. These are people in the course, and a very proud participant at the end of the course. So many of the basic things that we almost consider, we almost don't think about in terms of public health were very important in this camp and were very effective. Surveillance, in fact, surveillance helped to identify the polio outbreak early on. And even though we didn't have absolute confirmation of all suspected 9 cases, it was enough to set in motion the polio immunization program. One of the things that I know strikes many of us when we work in other settings, such as refugee camps or other crisis situations abroad, is we end up being contributed to a lot more than we think we can contribute to others. And that was certainly our experience here. And seeing the hope as reflected in the children's faces shown here and their willingness to go on, often without parents or close relatives, having seen their country and their communities destroyed, was uplifting, but not to ignore the fact that they will no doubt have scars for life, physically and certainly mentally, and seeing the dignity that people had despite all they had gone through. So I want to talk briefly, and this is not giving adequate attention to the subject, about 7 of the adverse health consequences of war on non-combatant civilians as listed here. I'll go through them one by one. There are, of course, other ways of grouping them, but I found this a useful way. So one is direct impacts on health. People who died directly as a result of war and related conflicts. In the 20th century, it's estimated that 200 million people died as a result of this. Not only wars, but Mao's great march in terms of getting people moved to the countryside, often without their basic needs being met and so forth. There were a lot of other Stalin's war on a lot of the Soviet citizens at the time. So it includes not only war, but other major crisis situations. One of the things, if one looks over the course of the 20th century, is that if you go from World War I to wars in the 1990s, there's an increasing proportion of deaths in any given war, an increasing proportion of those deaths are due to deaths among non-combatant civilians. A very disturbing situation. Not only civilians who are caught in the crossfire, so to speak, but increasingly civilians who are targeted, women who are raped, children who are kidnapped, not by accident, but by design. It's a way of, unfortunately, that wars are being fought. Sometimes these are called low-intensity conflicts. In my mind, there's no such thing. It's really a low-intensity war. People might argue of the exact numbers here. Some of these are numbers derived from materials that Dr. Lukian has developed over time in the Vietnam War. About 4 million deaths, civilian deaths, perhaps as many as 1 million widows in South Vietnam alone, 800,000 orphans in South Vietnam alone. We don't have accurate figures for North Vietnam. In the Iraq War, again, the data I mentioned earlier, and perhaps as many as 1 million widows, taking into account not only the so-called Iraq War from 2003 to 2011, but the Persian Gulf War in 1991 and the Iran-Iraq War, when we were on the side of Iraq promoted their use of chemical weapons in that war against Iran from 1980 to 1988. Some of those weapons actually used by Saddam Hussein against his own people, the Iraqi citizens. Military deaths, certainly a large number, 58,000 U.S. military deaths, many wounded, over 300,000, but these numbers are small compared to the non-combatant civilian deaths. Similarly, in the Iraq War, so much of the research is on U.S. service members or U.K. service members and so forth, but very little of the research is really done on the morbidity and mortality and disability inflicted on non-combatant Iraqis or Vietnamese. There are many mental health consequences, and again, I apologize for giving the subject short shrift, but they range from PTSD to depression, anxiety, alcohol and drug abuse, violence perpetrated by returning service members back to the United States or their native countries, violence against family members and suicide, very high suicide rates among military. The second area is adverse effects on medical care and public health services. Physicians, nurses, other health workers are injured or killed or flee. And they may not flee the country, but for example, in Iraq, many of them fled from Baghdad into rural areas, and although they may still practice medicine or nursing or whatever there, they're doing it with less support and certainly not as effectively. Damage to clinics and hospitals, although I think most people, most sane people would agree that there should be medical neutrality and there should not be bombing and other damage directed towards clinics and hospitals, but unfortunately it happens not only by accident, but often purposefully. Reduction of public health services, reduced medications and vaccines. Of course, it's difficult to maintain the cold chain that's necessary for certain vaccines during war. Perhaps if you take away one thing from this talk, I'd like among those things, or that one thing, to be the fact that so much of the damage in terms of morbidity, mortality, disability as a result of a war is due to damage to the health supporting infrastructure shown here, damage to the food safety, water supply, sewage, electrical power, and so forth, and not only during the war itself, but its aftermath. In fact, the sanctions that occurred from 19, actually even before the Persian Gulf War, from 1990 to 1998, prevented parts to repair the water treatment plants so that unsafe water was consumed by Iraqis even after the Persian Gulf War ended. And in fact, as a result of those sanctions, it's estimated by the UN, by UNICEF actually, that there were at least 400,000 excessive children deaths during that period of time. Damage to the environment. This photo and the next one are pictures from Vietnam by Arthur Westing from Vermont. They both show damage to mangrove swamps. This is damage due to defoliation due to Agent Orange, which probably had effects not only in terms of damage to plant life, but people who were exposed. There's evidence of certain forms of cancer is associated with dioxin, which was a contaminant of Agent Orange. This is also damage of mangrove swamps. And by the way, mangrove swamps are nature's way of purifying, you know, water, in a sense. That's anthropomizing nature. But you're seeing here a number of circles. These are bomb craters, which contained water. This is an area where mosquitoes transmit malaria and other diseases, and so some of the damage to the environment was not only damage to the environment per se, but created ways of transmission, increased ways of transmission of human disease as a result of vectors such as mosquitoes breeding in these areas of stagnant water. Refugees and internally displaced persons. Unfortunately, I've increased these numbers since last year's presentation on a similar topic. They're the largest number of refugees and internally displaced persons in the world now since the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, has been keeping these statistics. For the first time, it's 50 million or more. About 17 million refugees who have escaped their own countries, 33 million internally displaced persons. So unfortunately, the situation's getting worse, and some numbers here from various specific conflicts. Refugees and internally displaced persons are vulnerable for lots of reasons, less security, less access to safe water and food, poor sanitation, et cetera, inadequate shelter and clothing, and less medical care and public health services. Human rights violations are a major concern, assaults on civilians, ethnic cleansing I've already talked about, targeting of women, rape as a weapon of war, abduction of children, violations of the Geneva Conventions, violations of medical neutrality, diversion of not only financial resources but human resources. It was a Republican president who said every gun that is made, in fact, a former general in World War II, Dwight Eisenhower, said every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. Military expenditures, again, it's hard to even begin to imagine the size of these numbers. Rather than using the words million or billion, I put zeros in that, you know, indicate at least in a numerical way the size of this. We lead the world in military expenditures. These are data from 2012 in the yearbook of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, which, by the way, puts out annual yearbooks that have outstanding and accurate statistics on things like military expenditures. Europe, excluding Russia, almost $500 billion, China, 166 billion and so forth, Russia 91 billion. The United States rankings, and this comes from the, some far left group did not make up these rankings. These come out of the CIA handbook from 2013 that show that we're number one in arms exports, military expenditures, military technology, but 51st, and the number coincidentally is just the same, 51st in life expectancy among the nations in the world, and 51st in the infant mortality rate. Now, you could argue that from an absolute number, it's not that different, but we are the richest country in the world, and these are not made-up numbers. These are numbers from the CIA handbook, 51st in infant mortality and life expectancy, a crime. Diversion of financial resources is a major issue. Somebody calculated, actually a reputable group calculated, that the first $204 billion spent in the Iraq war could have achieved all of the following for 3 years: 50% decrease in world hunger, comprehensive program against HIV/AIDS, complete immunization of all children in the less developed country, and meeting the needs worldwide for clean water and sewage treatment. I mean, you know, our Congress doesn't think twice about approving a new set of bombers or other kinds of weapon systems, but that even a small amount of that money could have make a major difference in terms of health, not only in other countries, but in our own country. And we need to be thinking, as the Ebola crisis has shown us, that Ebola anywhere is Ebola everywhere, and risks to biosecurity anywhere are risks to risk to security everywhere. So that what's happening in some far reach, remote area of the world relates directly to our security at home. Even in our own self-interest, we should be addressing these problems like hunger and illiteracy and so forth. And finally, the last area is that violence promotes more violence. Some of the reasons why some people become terrorists is because their family has been, killed as a result of violence brought upon it by another country, sometimes by the United States. I don't mean to say that's the only reason to explain terrorism, but violence begets other violence. Adding to that is the fact that the arms trade is continuing to increase. Again, these are data from SIPRI, from their annual yearbook. These are international transfers of major conventional weapons, which increased 56% from 2000 to 2012. The largest supplier of major conventional weapons remain the United States, 30%, Russia with 23% of the total, and so forth, as shown here. And I want to end the talk on a hopeful note. Many problems in public health, and war, of course, is a public health problem, we've used various frameworks of thinking about public health problems and adapted them to many situations. So, for example, the host agent environment, how many have had this in their public health training at somewhere along the way or have taught it? Okay. So you could take malaria, for example, and you could focus on perhaps getting a vaccine someday, or telling people to stay indoors when mosquitoes are out and about, or wear long sleeve shirts and trousers, or use insect repellent. You could have mosquito eradication campaigns focus on the agents, or getting rid of stagnant pools that I showed before. Arguably, that's an environmental measure. But the fact is, we can not only focus on each of the points on this triangle, but the lines in between are arguably the space in the middle where we combine various approaches. And arguably, the same approach could be taken towards war. So instead of having host, agent, environment, we have people, weapons and military, and conditions in which people live. And this is not the only way to think about it, but this may be a helpful way of thinking about how to address war as a public health problem. So there are strategies that could be aimed at people, as shown here, promoting understanding among peoples, promoting economic and social interdependency among nations, promoting nonviolent escalation nonviolent resolution of disputes and conflicts, and developing the popular and political will to prevent war and promote peace. There can be strategies, of course, aimed at weapons in the military, controlling the arms trade, eliminating weapons of mass destruction, which we haven't really talked about today, but of course is a major issue. So many of our own nuclear weapons are still on hair trigger alert against, I'm not sure who, Russia? In any event, and now there are efforts to rebuild our own nuclear arsenal, and Russia's planning to do the same. So we may be on the verge of another escalation of the nuclear arms race, reducing military expenditures and intervening in disputes early on to prevent war, just like intervening early on in the Ebola epidemic, if that was done, or intervening early on in the case of an individual person's illness or disease. And finally, strategies to improve the conditions in which people live, which are often the underlying causes of war, protecting human rights and civil liberties, reducing poverty and economic disparities, improving education, employment opportunities, ensuring personal security and legal protections. And perhaps, finally, the only way to prevent the impact of war on non-combatant civilians is to end war itself. And that's a public health, I think, challenge for all of us. Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Yes. Well, you know, if I were king, I'd get rid of the monarchy and return to a democracy that was even a more pure democracy than we have here. Perfect question. It's the kind of question that we should be addressing as a group, and we as APHA should be addressing. And it ranges from everything, you know, the things I've outlined here on this slide, and I don't mean to pretend that any of these are easy, but a way of thinking about how we as public health professionals and students and others can you know, move towards a world without war, a culture of peace. We need to start with an ideal and figure out ways of how to achieve it. And it may include some things that we consider outside the public health realm, like campaign finance reform, okay? So I think, you know, somebody once said, actually it was the Institute of Medicine who once said, 1988, in their future public health report, said public health is what we as a society, as a global society, do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. So it's not only what we do in public health or, well, you know, what me as king, and I wouldn't want to be king, but in answer to your question, what we can facilitate happening in society, there are no easy answers here, but I think each of us needs to begin asking in our own way, you know, what can we do? I mean, I know Myron has done this and others have done this. You know, one of the things I did after working in the Cambodian refugee camp, and it was 34 years ago, I've shown these slides and a whole bunch of other slides in many different forums, from government committees to elder centers to daycare centers to a lot of public health meetings, sharing that experience. I think, you know, one of the things that is not talked about very much is the subject of my presentation. You know, what are the consequences of war? How many people have relatives in their family who served in a war and with whom they've never had a conversation? You know, they've never really had a conversation of what that was like. I mean, war is hell, you could say, or hellish, okay? And a lot of what really happens in war is not talked about. In fact, I think that's part of the reason why so many people, service members, come back with serious mental health problems, is that there isn't a way of talking about that and sharing that, the agony of having gone through that and the angst, and I'm not even finding the right words, but there's so little talk, relatively speaking, about what are the consequences of war. I think we need to be talking not only to ourselves but to a wider community about what are the consequences of war, and is that something that we as an American people want to continue to support? So I don't, it's a perfect question. It's the question we should be asking. I don't think there's an easy answer, and I don't know if you want to comment further. Yes.
And when people describe what they did, sometimes it's the first opportunity to share a very traumatic experience or to share an incredible exposure that they may have had to
right.
You know, toxic
Yes. Thank you.